Hello. Welcome to Profiles. I'm Patrick O'Mara. Our guest today is Michael McRobbie, Interim Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Indiana University, Bloomington. Michael, congratulations on your new appointment.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
I was looking at your experiences in Australia, and it's intriguing to me that you started your academic career at the University of Queensland, and then went on to the Australian National University, and after other interesting academic experiences, came to Bloomington and to Indiana University.
That's right.
Tell us a little more about how this happened and the transition in coming to the United States from Australia.
I did all my education in Australia and did my first degree at the University of Queensland, as I think as you mentioned, in the city of Brisbane, which is the largest northerly city in Australia. After that, I went to the Australian National University, which is the country's best university, and did my doctorate there in a wonderful academic setting with first-rate people. It's interesting, as people probably know, some people will know, I met Mike Dunn, the Dean of Informatics at IU, when I was a graduate student and when he was a Fulbright Fellow there in 1975. So Mike and I have known each other over 30 years. And did my doctorate there, then was a postdoc for a period at the University of Melbourne, then came back to ANU and ended up as a professor there and running a large centre and various other things. I had visited the United States a lot through my academic life, my research life, and through various professional commitments, committees, conferences, and things like that. Was here regularly. Many of the people that I worked with in research and other areas were based at universities here. I liked the U.S. generally. I was always very impressed with the higher education system here. I mean, it is the best in the world. It's I think acts as a magnet to people like myself from all over the world. I've enjoyed the real flexibility of the system here and the creativity that the American system of higher education at its very best allows, and had often been interested in working here. And I reached a level in the Australian system where it would have been difficult to have continued to stay involved in technology, which at the time was what I was interested in doing. So, in 1996, I was invited to apply for the then new position of Vice President for Information Technology, and was eventually appointed to the position and professorships in computer science and philosophy.
Michael, how did you know when you were a teenager or when you were in high school that technology was what you wanted to do? How did you know that this was going to be where the world was going to be moving? What inspired you?
I'm a classic baby boomer. I was born in 1950, and when I went to high school, in those days in Australia, you started high school at grade 9, and that was in 1964. And of course, that was just after the beginning of the boom in science funding worldwide. Obviously, here in the United States, but also in Australia, the then national government made a major investment in science facilities at high schools all across the nation, really quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I had been interested in various scientific areas, but my interests have always been very broad. I've always had a love of history and of various periods, classical history in particular in some cases. But nevertheless, I think it was science that most intrigued me. And the post-Sputnik era was just as real in Australia as I think it probably was here in the United States. And that drew me into science. Most of my friends and contemporaries and peers were all doing science of various kinds. But they had broad interests, which was surprising given where I grew up, which was basically the surfing capital of Australia.
So you made the great transition from Australia to Bloomington.
Yes.
Your children, at the time they came, they were quite young. They're now, one of them's in college, another one is in high school. How have they adapted to coming to the United States?
Well, they sound like locals now. They they no longer sound like Australians, and I still do to some extent, but they don't. I think they've adopted very well. I think it was probably, the move was probably hardest for my eldest daughter, Josephine, who's a senior here at IU, she came from the end of grade six in Australia from a warm Australian summer where she just finished grade six to the beginning of second semester in grade seven in the middle of a deep, dark Indiana winter. All of that transition took place within a week, and I think she found that a tiny bit difficult. And the middle school is a difficult period for children and for students in this country. And she found the transition a little difficult, but she handled it well. And then she went to high school and has come to university. I think in the last couple of years, she really has blossomed. And I mean, just been delighted with that in terms of how well she's adapted to the American university system. And then my two younger children are now both at South, one a sophomore and one a freshman. And I have a stepdaughter there too, who's also a sophomore. But my two children have adapted very well to the American high school system, which frankly is not that different to what it was in Australia.
What do they think about Australia? Because you went back with them. I think you've been back a couple of times.
We go back about every year to see relatives and friends. And they always enjoy going back to see their grandparents and their uncles and aunts and friends of ours who they still remember. They always enjoy it, but I think they're happy here. My son is a world expert on Indiana basketball and knows little of the sports that I grew up with in Australia. And my 14-year-old is, I think, a typical American 14-year-old teenager. So,
and two of the children are great swimmers, which probably is the genetic side of Australia coming out in swimming.
That's right. If they ever get so good that they get to Olympic standards in swimming, the question is, which country do they swim for?
Tell me about education, the British system, which is one of the ways in which Australian universities operate. And especially at the graduate level, it's quite different at an American university.
It is.
Do you find benefits to both? Do you think the American system has advantages that maybe the Australian universities will emulate?
Yes, I think the American higher education system, or the university system in general, is generally acknowledged to be the best in the world. I think it particularly shows itself at the graduate level. And what you find there, what I think is the distinguishing characteristic is the use of coursework. When I did my doctorate, in fact, a number of the faculty were from America, very distinguished scholars, and it was not the custom to have coursework. They actually instituted some, and we did some amount of coursework. Most of the focus in the British system, as you know, was on the thesis itself.
Yes, exactly.
And you can spend 4 or 5 years just churning out one very deep piece of work in a relatively narrow area, and that's the difference. I think I remember my principal PhD supervisor, who's American, said that he actually preferred the British system because he thought you ended up with a more substantial thesis. I've seen both. I've seen excellent theses in this country and excellent ones in Australia. But I think sometimes in the British system, you don't get as broad an education as a graduate student as you do in the American system.
It's a very solid one. Yeah.
It's very solid, and it really does qualify somebody to be a practitioner.
Mm-hmm. And to teach as well.
Exactly. Which I think the British system is not as good as in terms of doing that as the American system.
One of the things I've been very interested in is your great awareness and sensitivity towards Southeast Asia, towards Asia. The Australian geographic location, of course, has made you well aware of Asia. Before you came to IU, you were very much involved with relationships in Japan, I think, in other parts of Asia. And that's continued when you've been here.
Yes.
But it might be useful for us to understand a little more about the roots of this, because you were building relationships before you even came to IU.
Yes. Well, it's a sort of an amusing story in some ways. My knowledge of Japan up until about the mid-80s was confined to sushi and the movies of Kurosawa. Yes. I think it was about 1986, my then boss asked me to take responsibility for a new research and development agreement between ANU, where I then was, and the Japanese computer company Fujitsu, which is the Japanese IBM. It's their mm-hmm. biggest computer company. This involved paying a visit to Japan, which I'd never done before. And knowing very little about the business customs, I made a fateful decision whether I should wear a suit or jeans to my first meeting. Well, luckily I chose the suit, and of course it turned out to be something akin to the treatment you would get if you were a member of the royal family or something. It was truly amazing. I very rapidly learnt how to do business and work with the Japanese, and we put in place in that period I was at ANU what the Japanese company said was the largest R&D agreement they had with any university in the world, and I think it was about a $20 million agreement over a 5 to 6 year period. And I would be in support of that, and then I started doing things that were involved with the Australian government and some other organizations. I did some work for the OECD, and I would be in Japan four or five times a year, and maybe other parts of Asia, and then I'd be in the US three or four times a year. So I would normally be overseas 7 to 8 times a year. So it was very helpful moving here because it cut down on travel quite a bit.
I know about your great interest in sushi. In fact, I've watched you in Japan eating sushi. I've never been to a sumo wrestling match with you, but you know, you are now a senior university administrator at Indiana University. Basketball is the major preoccupation at this university. Are you giving up your interest in sumo?
I'm going to adopt a sort of a one-man campaign to make sumo an NCAA sport. Now, I took a lot of interest in sumo as a sport when I first started going to Japan because it is as passionate a national preoccupation in Japan as baseball would be in summer in this country, or basketball is in winter in this country, and I guess football to some extent. When there is a sumo tournament on, and there are 6 of them a year every odd-numbered month, I doubt if there's a single person in Japan who doesn't know what's happening and who's leading in the tournament and so on as well. It's what's interesting about it is that it's been a sport that's been in place, I think, for over 100 years, extremely ritualized, and in fact goes back much more than 100 years, but I think in terms of modern records, and where the rules have been almost unchanged for that period. So it's actually, it gives you the opportunity to compare very accurately across the decades the quality of the champions. And it's interesting, at the moment there is the first ever Mongolian sumo wrestler at the very top level, which is called Yokozuna. And this gentleman, whose name is Asahi Ryu, he is probably one of the greatest that the sport of sumo has ever seen. And, of course, you see nothing about that in papers here, but this is somebody who is as dominant in his sport now as Michael Jordan was in basketball in this country. So I follow it partly because when I talk to my Japanese friends, it's a wonderful way to start conversations. I know what's going on in the sumo, and we can talk about, you know, who's winning, who's up, who's down, and stuff like that.
Is university administration a bit like a sumo wrestling match?
It has some of the characteristics of that. But the struggles take longer than they do in sumo.
We're about as normally over
in 30 seconds.
Well, I think this would be an interesting moment. We've been talking about Australia and about your life in Australia. Do you have a piece of music you might like to include at this point? Maybe reminiscent of your youth or of the time you spent in Australia?
No, having listened to this program before, I know that you play pieces of music by the people that you interview. I have very broad musical tastes. It doesn't mean I like everything, but I have very broad tastes. I love classical music, as I guess we may talk about later, particularly symphonic music, the symphonies of Mahler and Shostakovich, Bruckner, Beethoven, obviously, are all great favourites of mine. I like jazz, although I tend to be a purist. I think anything from the release of Miles Davis's kind of Blue Album onwards, I like. Not much before that. And I like rock music. I'm of the baby boom generation, so I grew up in the post-Beatles era. And in rock music, I'm particularly fond of the music at the sort of heavier end of the spectrum that came out of Britain, which means obviously people like the Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. And I saw Led Zeppelin in Australia in 1972, and it was, of all the rock concerts I saw in that period of my misspent youth when I used to go to rock concerts a lot, they were by far the best band I saw by an order of magnitude. And I've never heard anything quite as wild as that on the show, Patrick, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to do that.
That's an excellent
point. So I've chose the piece called Kashmir because it actually has a somewhat symphonic feel to it. It's quite a well-known piece, I think, to people who follow such things, and I thought it might be a lead into other kinds of music we might talk about later.
Well, I'm sure many of our students will be delighted at the choice of Led Zeppelin. What do your own children think of Led Zeppelin?
I want to be known as the rock and roll provost.
Well, that's
my son is very fond of it as well. I think it appeals more to young boys than it does to young women.
And he doesn't see it as antiquated at this point.
They're probably horrified. They like the same music as I do, actually.
Oh, that's wonderful. Let's move a little bit into the discussion of some of the great achievements, and they really have been great achievements. IU has been called the hottest campus, the most wired campus. All of these are really direct outgrowths of what you've done, and I also think you've made remarkable efforts to widen the network of Indiana University with the TransPAC, which is the Trans-Pacific Network. These are all big achievements. Let's start perhaps with your first major change at IU, which I think was the whole question of creating UITS or Unified Technology Service. This would be an important point for us to begin with and maybe expand on that.
Well, I came to the university to take up the position as vice president for IT. As I think we said before, in 1997, beginning of 1997. And the goal that then-President Brand gave me was to try to make us, in his oft-repeated words, a leader in the uses and applications of information technology. Now, the thing that was becoming clear even back then was that information technology was no longer balkanized. Standards were starting to emerge, without obviously going into details. It was no longer the case that you had multiple ways of connecting computers, that the number of packages for people to use on the desktop for word processing and so on had reduced markedly from what it had been like 10, 15 years before that. And I think it became clearer that this was one area where it didn't really make sense to have a situation where one had a highly balkanized series of IT organizations. So the way I saw it was that we really needed to combine our resources together and leverage them in total to maximize our ability to use those to support the fundamental research and teaching mission of the university. And I always stress to people, you don't do IT for its own sake unless you happen to be in computer science. Why we support IT and why IT is so important is because it is these days a fundamental enabler of research and teaching. There's basically no area of research that isn't affected by information technology to greater or lesser degree. And more often than not these days, it's to greater degree. I was at a NEH meeting, National Endowment for the Humanities meeting in Washington a few weeks ago, where there were a number of classics professors talking about virtual reconstructions of Rome and how they're doing that in a highly scholarly way. And that's just one example. And of course, in the sciences, it's abundantly well known. So to me, the excellent universities of the future are going to be those that have excellent IT. And I saw my role at the time and my brief at the time to create as excellent IT as it was possible to provide for the university.
You have a remarkable place on this campus called the Cave,
Yes.
And I've had the good fortune to bring many distinguished visitors there, ranging from Mikhail Gorbachev to others. That's an interesting place. It would be interesting also for us to hear from you about the cave.
Well, it's basically a large virtual reality system that enables an individual to be completely immersed in a virtual world. It's a cube of about, from memory, about a 9-foot side, and it has images projected on all the walls, and they're stereo images such that if you wear a certain kind of special headset, you see that stereo image as a three-dimensional image. It looks like a kind of reality. What this enables not only individuals but groups of individuals to do is to actually work in this three-dimensional space. Now, I just happened to mention the Virtual Rome before. That particular program that came out of UCLA is basically a virtual three-dimensional reconstruction of Rome that actually enables you to traverse the whole centre of the city of Rome as it was at about the time of Constantine, and enables one to actually look at a particular reconstruction of a particular building, but then to see it in three dimensions from multiple perspectives, and actually travel around it as if one was actually in the real place. But then all of it is heavily annotated with all the scholarly detail and even some of the debates about whether or not this is the correct reconstruction of this particular building. Now, to me, that's just one beautiful example of how that kind of modern technology can be used right in the middle of the humanities, which, after all, is one of the fundamental strengths of this university. And, of course, if one goes to the life sciences, where being able to understand the three-dimensional structure of very large molecules is very important in many areas of the life sciences.
Or even the human body.
In the human body, and how they interact together or don't interact together. When you're trying to design a drug and you want to, if you like, plug into one molecule, and exactly how that plugging in works is something that people explore in three dimensions. Now, the cave is a facility that enables you to do that on a very large scale in three dimensions, but enables you to work on it with colleagues directly with you there, but in other places as well. We have another cave up in Indianapolis. The two caves can be connected, so you can have people working in both, and both of them sharing the same data and exploring the same data together.
When President Gorbachev went to the cave, your staff arranged the visit. He asked to go into outer space to visit the Sputnik, and of course your staff was very capable and arranged this. And in 3D, he was walking in outer space. A week later, I had a group of Russian rectors coming, and they said to me, "So, he went to outer space. Why didn't you leave him there?" So,
I must say, I should add as a side comment, as a most unfair comment about Mr. Gorbachev. I think he will emerge as one of the great heroes of the last century.
A prophet without honor.
Indeed.
Tell us about Internet 2, because to me this is one of the most exciting things the university has been involved in. The Abilene project is innovative. It's going to open up tremendous possibilities. It's already opened up tremendous possibilities with broadband communication. How did we get it, and what's your great hope for it?
Well, it's particularly exciting to me because my wonderful new wife works for Internet 2, but Internet 2 is a national consortium of about 200 research universities and other organizations in this country. It was established by these universities, or by a subset of them, about 8 or 9 years ago now. And what the motivation was that the Internet as we know it today, the commercial Internet, was originally a network that had been funded by the National Science Foundation and was basically just for the universities. There came a point where it became so popular that the National Science Foundation and the universities effectively spun it off to the commercial sector, and it's become the Internet of today that connects something like 1 billion people in the world. And if I remember the figures rightly, something like 15% of all world commerce is now carried out over the Internet. I mean, really quite remarkable. It's gone to that from nothing in about 10 years, a little over 10 years. Now, at exactly the moment that the universities lost the Internet, as it were, but they could still use it, but it was now a commercial thing, a lot of people felt that they were losing the ability to sort of innovate with high-speed, high-capacity communications, and it was necessary to actually create a new network that would be just for higher education research and would enable universities to have control over that infrastructure to have control over the network in the same way that they originally had control over the original internet, the internet one that you might think of it that way. So that was how it was born, and an actual network was put in place. The organization that runs Internet 2 put out a call for people to bid on running the network. We applied and were successful and were awarded the contract, and we've run it ever since 1998.
This is going to make all kinds of things possible. Sharing research data, large quantities of research data, communication, visual communication, all kinds of interaction that are moving these institutions into a network that is at the cutting edge.
Why IT is so important in higher education is that it is one of the fundamental enablers of research and education, research and teaching. And what it does is it provides the connection. It's the glue that connects together all the workstations and servers in the individual laboratories. There's probably, again, no area of science or research or scholarship that now doesn't take place on a global level. That is, that scholars use databases, they use facilities, they use large-scale supercomputing resources all over the world in their particular community. And what makes that possible and what gives them almost instantaneous access to new developments in the field or new capabilities with new resources is the internet, and in particular, in the case of universities here, it is Internet 2, and that's what enables us to have that very high-speed connection. Now, it's sort of invisible to people. Probably most faculty of the university don't realize that whenever they deal with some database at Stanford or Princeton or something, that all of that is taking place over Internet 2 and not the commercial internet.
I was in Washington recently, and I was amazed that DuPont Circle is now fully wireless. Out of doors, you see people walking around with their computers without any connections.
Right.
We're moving to that, I assume, as a campus.
Oh, absolutely. The campus is now completely wireless for pretty much all of the campus. In fact, frankly, I know some places make a lot out of being wireless. It's all but trivial now to do that. I mean, the technology is very straightforward. It's something I think it's not even worth bragging about. It's like saying that you've got lots of restrooms to say that you're wireless.
That you're wireless. Yeah, I agree.
It's not at all interesting anymore. There are still lots of interesting possibilities, I think, in the broader world. It's now possible to get accounts with companies that give you wireless connectivity at airports in Starbucks and other places like that, and that then really expands the reach of wireless networking and especially for people in the universities who travel a lot. Those are really important developments.
Do you see us moving more and more into the commercial area? Because we've got a for-profit dimension of the university now. Do we have capacity to move into areas of distributing rights, selling new inventions in this area?
This has been, I think, ever since the Bayh-Dole Act back in, I think it was 1980 when that was passed, where basically there were certain incentives and imperatives placed on the universities to commercialize the products of their research. I mean, if you look at modern information technology, most of the innovations in modern information technology came out of university laboratories. There's been lots of very detailed studies that show this as well. Some universities have gained from it, some haven't, and so on. I think in this state, through a number of initiatives, the pervasive technology laboratories and other initiatives, there's been an attempt to try to commercialize the products of the research there relatively successfully. A number of small companies have
been set up.
You've been
involved in that, of course.
I established the Pervasive Technology Labs.
Exactly, with a considerable amount of capital.
With a $30 million grant from the Lilly Endowment, for which we're immensely grateful. They've been extraordinarily generous. And then recently we established the MetaCyte initiative, the Metabolomics and Cytomics Initiative on this campus that also has a similar focus, that's run by people in the life sciences, and that has a similar focus. And it just made its first couple of investments, too, in small companies that are looking to commercialize intellectual property that's come out of research in the life sciences on this campus as well. I think this is very important for universities to be giving this attention so that if there are these commercial opportunities that come out of the work of faculty, that there are mechanisms to enable that to end up benefiting those faculty members.
Yeah, exactly. We've been talking a lot about IT and technology and change, but of course we also heard that you've got a great interest in the arts and in music, and you're an avid reader. Tell us about New Frontiers in the Arts and Humanities, because that's been an important initiative for this university.
Yeah. It's something I've been very pleased with. That really, I think you could think of that as being a way to try to respond to the needs of the scholars in the arts and humanities at this university in a variety of different ways. The principal way is really grants to assist those scholars in the production of new works of art, whether that be pieces of music or new performances and so on, and new books, new poetry, and the range of things is really quite broad, and that's been a very successful. It's been oversubscribed about 4-1, and we've just funded our second round of proposals under that program. One even sees in the last couple of months there's been a number of performances in various areas that have been funded by New Frontiers grants. It was the modern dance program a few months ago was funded through that, and I know there's some other programs coming up. That's one of it. One of the parts of that program. A second part is a program to support workshops and conferences. It's funding what I happened to be talking about yesterday when I gave a talk, a new program on films in Indiana. Mm-hmm. And then a third part is a program to bring in visitors for sustained periods of time, not just for a few days, but for 5, 6, 7 weeks at a time. And then finally, there's a component that provides travel grants to faculty up to a significant amount to enable faculty to not only go within the US, but to go overseas as well. Pretty much all components of that program have been oversubscribed, in particular the first part, been widely oversubscribed. And I think what it shows is just how vigorous and dynamic the arts and humanities are on this campus.
So that's my question, though. You see, I've seen you at the opera. I've heard you open Arts Week. But we've also been talking about technology. Now, so many young people see their futures in IT. What about the arts and humanities? Should we be encouraging our students to engage in careers in the arts and humanities? What's the place in a Research One university of arts and humanities?
Well, I often say that if you really take a long-term view of the sort of the intellectual world, you could imagine that it'll be possible, maybe even our lifetimes, but it'll be possible to provide all the computing capacity and really excellent artificial intelligence-based software to handle all the needs that you'll ever have. In a sense, you'll be able to almost solve all the problems of IT and provide all the capabilities anybody could ever want. And then if you think about the promise, and certainly a lot of the things that people say about the impact of the genomic revolution, all the things that will follow from the ability to completely sequence genomic material that followed from the Human Genome Project, that one day this will give us maybe the capability to completely cure disease. And if one is able to rectify disease and aging and things like that to a very significant degree, such that they become far less problematic in society, you're still left with the big questions. You know, why is there something rather than nothing? You know, what is the good? What is the beautiful? And all the great questions that philosophers have wrestled with for thousands and thousands of years. And those are, at their very best, the kinds of problems and issues that universities have wrestled with for the 1,000 years plus that they've been in existence in Western civilization. And those are the kinds of questions, again, at their best, that really are, I think, at the root of the arts and humanities.
Now that we've been talking about the arts and humanities, do you have a piece of music that would be appropriate for this discussion?
Again, my tastes are broad and somewhat eclectic in the arts. I think one of the great awakenings, I think, artistic awakenings, was when I first visited Florence in 1980, I think it was, and saw the paintings of Fra Angelica there. I was just stunned with the beauty and magnificence of those paintings that were, 700 or something years old. But I'm a great fan of modern art. I like modern abstract art, although I collect modern abstract art, and there's a some sort of remarkable connection between modern abstract art and jazz. I mean, I'm not the first person. Millions before me have noted that connection. In fact, if one looks at the covers of many jazz records, famous jazz records, they happen to be pieces of modern art. I have a love, somewhat narrow love of jazz as well, particularly the works of Miles Davis and John Coltrane. And I think there's maybe no greater work in the jazz idiom than John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. And I've sort of chosen the first movement from that that magnificent record, of which, or CD, I guess, in this case, of which there's been a book written about recently, which I think is quite a fine book as well. So that was my first choice, Patrick.
This is Profiles, and we have as our guest Michael McRobbie, who is the Interim Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Indiana University Bloomington. Michael, that was an exceptional piece of music, the excerpt from John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. We started off with Led Zeppelin, we've moved to Coltrane. I'm waiting with great interest to see the piece we'll fade out with. I'm sure our listeners will be equally interested.
Something maybe a little more sort of mainstream, Patrick, to end with.
You've recently become Interim Provost of the University. That's an important position, and it marks a significant new direction for Indiana University. First of all, what is a provost?
Well, the provost in the American university system is the chief academic officer, the academic leader of the campus, and that's what this role encompasses, the provision of academic leadership for the campus, much more focused on that than probably was previously the case.
Do you find real challenges? You've been in the job for a couple of months now.
Less than two months.
But you've had a chance to meet a lot of our deans.
Yes.
You've had a chance to do conferences with people. What are you learning that is different from your previous position as Vice President for Research and for Information Technology? What are you discovering as you begin to move into this new domain?
I think I'm gaining an added appreciation of the critical role that the deans all play. I mean, I was obviously well aware of that. Many of the deans are personal friends, who I think very highly of. But I think one really realizes how the deans and the schools really are the engine rooms of the university. I mean, at the end of the day, the university is about research and teaching. It's about the faculty who teach the students, and the deans are the people who basically provide the overall disciplinary structure in certain areas. So I think I'm gaining a good appreciation of that, or deepening of my appreciation of that. I think I'm also learning about areas that I was maybe less aware of, how good we were at them. I certainly knew we were good in many areas, but been meeting some of the people I hadn't met before in some of those areas, and have gone to lectures and talks, and looked at material from some of those people and areas and so on. And one can't help but be impressed with the quality of the academic enterprise at Bloomington.
And the range.
Oh, the range is prodigious. Yeah, it's quite remarkable.
I think it's a good point, because this is a tier one research institution
right.
in
right.
every sense of that
Absolutely.
Term.
Yeah.
But you'd still like to see it perhaps moving in new directions.
I think so. I've said this now for two or three years that, to me, one of the biggest impediments to this campus, I think, maybe moving forward as strongly as it should, is space, is research space and teaching space. We have a real lack of that on this campus. In my previous role, I was involved in carrying out a pretty thorough survey of this, and we're short probably a couple of million square feet in terms of the space that we really need here. And the thing about space is that it's what enables people to establish the labs and the offices and the facilities and even maybe, you know, galleries and practice studios and all the rest of it that enable them to do their research and carry out their scholarship and to train students, undergraduates, graduate students. But if you want to grow, and if a major component of that is external funding, you've got to have space to put people if you're successful at it. And we've been very successful. I mean, $477 million of externally funded research on both campuses, both mainly on the two major campuses last year, was a pretty remarkable achievement. But I'm seeing it every day that people are successful, they get money externally from the National Science Foundation or other agencies and so on, and they've got no space to put the people who are funded with that money or the equipment that's funded with that money. And that, to me, is almost the number one problem that we have to address. The other problem is how to retain the excellent faculty we have here and how to recruit the new faculty who will replace that some fairly large coterie of faculty who are retiring. We have somewhat of a demographic bulge, as you know, the people who on whom a lot of the reputation of this university has been based, who are retiring now, will be retiring over the next 5 or 10 years. How are we going to be able to compete in what's becoming a very strong marketplace for those people to ensure that we stay at the same level of excellence that those people so ably contributed to over the last 20 or 30 years?
What about attracting students? Let's start with graduate students. That's an important area. Of course, you made a major contribution for Australian students a few weeks ago when you cooked lamb for our students from Australia at your home. But what about attracting graduate students? Is this an important priority for you?
Well, I don't think we can cook for all of them, Patrick.
But, no.
Absolutely. I think by just about any estimate, graduate students account for about a third of the research enterprise. If there have been studies to this effect, they do about a third of the research, they do about a third of the teaching. And I believe those figures are roughly true on this campus as well. Graduate students are a critical part of the research enterprise. I would like to see our numbers increase. It means we've got to look at how we can provide more fellowships, how we can provide fellowships that have more funding attached to them as well. That varies from area to area, but that's got to be a priority. These things are easier to say than to do, but people are aware that if we want to try to climb the ranks as a research university, that's got to be one of our priorities as well.
The Board of Trustees recently discussed ways of perhaps improving the quality of entering undergraduate students. Do you see this as an important direction?
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt that the university is moving in the direction of being a stronger university academically in that regard. What's really struck me in the nearly 2 months I've been in this job is that I think it's the universal view of faculty to whom I've spoken. To them, the quality of the student that we have has a direct impact on their enthusiasm as teachers in the university. I think we've even had cases where retention has been an issue in that regard as well. So I think as we maybe start to become a more selective institution as well, that in turn is part of the strategy of becoming an even better research university as well. At the same time, a diverse student body is very important to the university. It's it's vital that we continue to give very strong attention to diversity and ensure that is maintained as we become more selective.
Yeah, I think that's a crucial question, because we do have a special responsibility to the diverse communities of which this university reflects in the state. Your daughter Josephine is going to graduate.
That's right.
You happy with the undergraduate education?
I think I'm happier with it at the end of her degree than I was at the beginning, to be frank. The sheer diversity of offerings and the complexity of it, I'm being quite frank about this, it worries me that maybe it's possible to get a degree without enough concentration in certain areas to have a very broad education across a variety of different areas, and that can be very advantageous in some areas. But at the end of it, you want to ask what has that student learned? What skills have they come out with? And have they got? I mean, we claim to be a liberal arts university. Have they really got the fundamental components of a liberal arts education? And that debate is going on within the university at the moment, in the context of general education and so on, that's clearly something and I think the trustees have already indicated they think we need to move more in that direction. The president has made that very clear from day one, and I think working out how to maybe move forward in that direction is going to be something we're going to be doing over the next couple of years.
The array of courses, the density of the availability of courses is quite dazzling.
Right.
The question is, of course, how to focus this.
That's right. That's the challenge. I remember when she was a freshman, trying to work. It's very interesting being a parent, because you get, it's like a microscope into our systems that you don't necessarily see from the other side. And I was struck with just how complex and difficult it is, and then how, at the same time, how easy it is maybe. Not to have that focus that you would like to see in a degree. I mean, I think you and I, going through a different kind of system some time ago, would have had very focused educations.
Yeah.
And I'm not certain that was a bad thing.
Michael, I want to ask a personal question.
Hmm.
Your wife, Andrea, was a good friend,
mm-hmm.
and you went through a very difficult time with her death.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be a father and an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
You had to run a pretty large operation. And you also had to deal with a significant transition for your children.
Mm-hmm.
Is it too personal, or would you like to comment on that?
Oh, no, I don't mind commenting on that. My late wife died of a brain tumor about 2.5 years ago or so, and it was... these things are never particularly pleasant, and I had to, during the period that she was ill with that, about 18-month, two-year period, I had the responsibility of raising the children during that. As I think I said at her, I think you were there at the memorial service for her. I couldn't have been prouder of my children, how well they handled that, and what fine young adults they are today.
Yeah, and that's a great testimony to both of you.
Well, I think it's a testimony to them, and it's a fitting way to remember her as well.
Yeah. Perhaps at this point we ought to look to the future. There are interesting questions about what a university is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
What is the classroom of the future? What kinds of changes are we going to see? I'm amazed myself in terms of everything from the kinds of equipment we have in our classrooms now. I walk in and... we have computers and screens and every kind of communicative device. Our students are using their computers on the internet. I had a class this week where I made an announcement about transparency index for corruption, and suddenly the student in the front row had this on her computer and said, "Yes, you're right, I have checked it." And I thought, good Lord, there's a different world we're dealing with. What are we going to see? Are we ready for the huge changes we're going to see? You've talked about